Whatever you may feel about the offensiveness of these two words, I think they categorize what he was talking about. And I think you'll agree that there are two groups of people.
Okay.
It's important to me to recognize that the speculator or reconstructors of this world represent a very large group. All of us have the capacity, in my mind, to reconstruct, to reorganize, to recombine things. And I think in our lives, the people who are listening to The Edge have already, to some degree in their life, validated that by doing something, by accomplishing something.
Mm-hmm.
Just the whole desire to start a business is a reconstruction of something somebody else did, and you, the business owner, the professional, didn't go into it because you wanted to be average. You probably went into it because you thought you could put a different edge, a different take, a different value, a different combination, a unique possibility to it.
Okay, sure.
Okay. So in my opinion, you, the listeners of this, are among the speculators. You are prepossessed with the inherent capacity to produce ideas. You've already done it. Your previous business initiatives, the fact that you started a business, you got it started, you put this vision that was abstract in your mind into reality, and you've taken it to some level and accomplished some level of success, is an testament to that. So you've got to learn how to train the mind. In learning any art, there are first principles to master and understand, and then there's method to apply. You've got to learn that, Marty.
Okay.
First of all, you should learn that bits of knowledge unconnected are nothing. Because they're too easily, these can be rapidly aging facts. Most people think that the trick in life is to come up with fragmented insights. Those are useless unless you integrate and connect them to a method of that you can apply to some action.
Okay.
Methods are everything in idea generation. Consequently, the habit of mind which leads to a search for relationships between facts and factors becomes the highest level of importance to somebody trying to develop an ability to produce and create a constant production of ideas. Okay, recognize this fact again, Marty. Ideas are nothing more than new combinations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're not foreboding or intimidating things. They're just recombinations, reorganizations, reconstructions. So I contend that in the production of ideas, the mind follows a method that is just as definitive as the method by which, say, the manufacture of a Ford or a Pontiac is done. These techniques of the mind follow five very predictable and simple steps. Number one, you gather the raw materials. I'm sure that this is obvious to people, but it's amazing to what a level this all-critical step gets completely ignored when people are trying to come up with ideas. They sort of sit there and they say, okay, and they sit at their desk or in their car or in bed or at their dinner table or out in the yard, and they squint their eyes and they furrow their brow and they think really hard and they generate the utmost of sweat and electrical energy and nothing happens. Have you ever noticed that?
I've seen that.
Okay. Instead of working systematically at the job of gathering new raw data to use or manufacture, most people sit around hoping for divine intervention. Okay?
I'm not against prayer, but...
No, I agree. I know you are. But the point is, that alone isn't going to do it for you. You've got to mount the right process.
Yeah.
So you've got to combine old elements into new ways. There are two important main principles which underlie the production of ideas. Okay, the first is that the recognition and acknowledgement that the fact that an idea is nothing more or less than a new combination of old elements. It's very important. What you're looking for is, how can I take old proven elements and combine them in an electric and a magnetic way that gives more power, more force, more benefit, more torque, more effectiveness? That's, you got to understand what's your goal. Most people don't understand what they're trying to accomplish, is it a mystery why you don't accomplish much if you don't know what you're trying to do and how you're trying to do it and why to do it and what the process entails? The second important principle involved is that the capacity to bring old elements into new combinations depends largely on your ability to see relationships. When a mind becomes quick to see relationships, Marty, relationships among things and relationships among occurrences, they lead to the extraction by the mind of a general principle. You're looking for the principles, the organizing principles that basically are the foundational elements behind things and occurrences. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
This general principle, when grasped, can suggest to you the key to new applications or new combinations. And the result is, aha, he gets an idea. Okay. The process, okay? So the first process is you gather the raw material. There's two kinds. There's very specific and there's very general. Whatever the subject you're trying to think of, what you want to do is inventory and categorize everything general known and then everything you can find specifically about the exact implication or the exact subject or the exact result or the exact area that you're trying to cultivate this idea on. Does that make sense to you?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so you're trying to construct new patterns. The best recommendation I can make is you start with 3x5 cards. You use these 3x5 cards to construct two things, as much specific and as much general information as you can, and you shuffle them. You shuffle them, you read them, you organize them, you think about them. The next step after you organize as much specific and as much general information as you can find, and you find it lots of different ways. First thing, you find it by starting with what you know and what your industry knows. Then you start questioning other people to learn what they know general and what they know specific. And you use the mastermind leverage principle of the brain trust. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Sure.
Well, it does. I'm thinking, does everyone remember what the mastermind brain trust principle is? Just summarize that real quick.
Well, the mastermind brain trust is the principle that was first of all uncovered by Napoleon Hill when he studied 500 of the greatest achievers and luminaries in industry, in the arts, in religion, in the military, in industry, in the early part of the 1900s. He studied 500 men and women around the world who had done things infinitely greater, more successful, more achievemental, more unprecedented than anybody else. And he looked at what the key elements of their success strategies that were universal were. And probably one of them was that the key achievers knew that they alone couldn't do it, so they'd plug into 20 or 30 or 200 people who would bring to bear their insights, their perspectives, their intellects, their experiences, and they'd ask them the same questions, and they'd throw them the problems, and they'd throw them the opportunities, and they'd get their input so they could leverage majestically and exponentially the mind power of so many other good people who've already been through that direct situation or permutations or had a different take than they did or saw life differently or saw life the same but on a deeper level.
Okay.
And that's what everybody has to do.
All right, go ahead.
You want to gather specific and general information, but you don't want to limit yourself dimensionlessly to one linear area or one arithmetic. You want to become exponential or geometric by plugging into 20 or 30. And depending on the area that you want, you want to know specifically and generally what everybody else you can tap into, who you respect, sees or knows or understands or has developed or can find out for you before you start trying to come up with your idea.
Okay.
Because you want to broaden your base of, I mean, if you have more ingredients to choose from, you're going to bake a better cake, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you've gotten all this information, you want to summarize it categorically by specific and general on 3x5 cards.
Okay.
And you want to shuffle them and organize them and put them in some order of relevancy or importance or universality. You know, if you talk to 20 or 120 people and 90% of them come up with the same points, you want to make sure you acknowledge and recognize those because those are probably key organizing principles. If then 10% come up with unique and nuanced ones, you want to make sure those are segregated too as specific, right?
Okay, sure.
You want to know what they see general and what they see specific. And you want to make sure that you ask yourself the right question. What is my idea supposed to accomplish? Because you've got to look transactionally at the result the idea is supposed to produce.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've come up with all this, then you've got to spend a lot of time studying it. But studying it not to resolve it, but just to acknowledge and recognize the distinctions, general and specific, and transfer it from those cards to your brain. Then you go through what I call the masticating or digesting or metamorphosizing portion where it just sort of develops in the wonderment of your subconscious mind.
Okay.
So you have to be able and content to do nothing. And this is hard for people who want immediate gratification and instant resolve. You let the wonderful, infallible ability of your unconscious mind flex its incredible and unused muscle to produce the outcome you seek.
Okay, and I sense that you've gone through this process.
I have, and you've got to be content to go through a relaxation mode, and that means that once you're ready to do this, you subordinate it or you defer it to your subconscious, and then you got to allow yourself to do the kind of activities that let the subconscious work, which means you relax. You go for a walk. You go for a bike ride. You go for a swim. You take your kid to the park or walk by a riverbed, or you go to a movie, or you go to the beach, or you go to the shopping center. You do whatever is relaxing and fun and diverts your conscious mind from too deep of thought. And while you're doing this, you take with you stacks of cards and pencils or pens, because it may take a day, it may take a week, it may take a month, but without fail, your subconscious will always give you not just an idea, but a great idea, the great idea that you've been looking for. However, when it's ready to erupt, it will explode out of your consciousness like Mount Vesuvius erupting. And if you're not prepared at that moment to preserve and capture it and make it your prisoner on paper forever, the odds are you will forget it, particularly if you're in the context of relaxing or swimming or whatever, and it will be gone forever. So you've got to make it your prisoner when it occurs.
Okay.
When that happens, you're not done. Because then the cold, gray dawn of the next day will occur, and you've got to then rework it and finalize it and improve it, and you've got to be judicious and merciless in your judgment, because you can have the greatest idea, but it needs perfection, and you need then to look at it in the clarity of a day or two or three, and you've got to ask other people's perspectives, not opinions, but perspectives, and use, again, your unconscious to dictate whether you incorporate derivatives or improvements from that. And you've got to go through this whole process, and if you'll do that, you've just learned from me an infallible process that will serve you forever and give you more great ideas that will improve your business, enhance your success, distinguish your marketing, and guarantee prosperity than you've ever imagined. It's easy, but it's got to be operated and followed diligently and continuously and trusted. That's it, Marty.
All right, Jay, usually we do the 10 ideas in 10 minutes, but let's postpone that for another time. Talk about, you have some incredible story about Australia and promotion. Can we talk
about
that?
I'd like to, Marty. I'd like to, but I want to make sure I tell people that I believe that there are a number of low or no-cost instant leverage points in operating your business, and one of the most overlooked, undervalued, underutilized, and underenjoyed is to incorporate and make ongoing structured promotion a joyous part of the way you do business. The whole premise of what I'm going to talk about is based on teaching people how and that they should do this. What I'd like to do is deal with an article that I brought back from Australia that I think it's funny, but it so demonstrates, illustrates, personifies, and underscores a grave void that most people in business are guilty of. Most people don't promote. They don't have any fun. They don't make doing business special. They don't give distinguishing reasons why their customers should take action with them or repurchase. They don't do anything like that, and they lose one of the easiest, most powerful leverage points in their business. When I was in Australia, I was getting myself a massage, and I was sitting in the lobby waiting, and I saw a marketing magazine that the owner was subscribing to, and I read it, and it was interesting. I turned to a page, and there was a picture of three young men, about 22, all standing naked with pieces of paper in front of their frontal genitals, looking very happy in front of a record stand, and there was a caption, and I've got it from it. It said, "New Day 1993 at Gaslight Music gained coverage in 24 national publications, including..." They list all these publications in Australia: Who, Weekly, The Age, Herald Sun, Sunday Age, The Australian, internationally. It was covered by The Star in Kuala Lumpur, Holland's national paper, and the Hong Kong Business Post. The electronic media coverage included 12 radio stations, 9 television news stations, internationally 7 radio stations covered the event, etc. Now I'm going to read the actual article. The headline says, "Gaslight Music, Melbourne, Victoria. When you walk into Gaslight Music, you're walking into much more than a music store. At any one time, you could find yourself walking into an in-store rock concert, the launch of a new CD, or a shop full of naked people. Gaslight Music houses Melbourne's most diverse range of music, specializing in CDs, tapes, and videos that you can't get anywhere else. But when it comes to in-store events, Gaslight has a well-known biannual customer participation calendar, which highlights special days, the most famous of which is Nude Day, with a free CD given to everyone who comes dressed in their birthday suit. Last report had 300 such people jammed into the store. They also feature Shave Your Head Day, Seeing Eye Dog Day, Speed Reading Day, Pet Fishes Day, Dancing Businessman Day, and many more. So full is their calendar with events that they have even created a No Big Deal at Gaslight Today Day. This has drawn a lot of publicity to the store. As an example of virtually an event a day, take a look at what they have in store for. And this article was in June, and they have the June schedule, Marty. And the point of this whole thing is most people don't even promote once a year. These people promote 365 days a year, and they make it special, and they make it exciting, and they make it an event, and they make doing business with them appealing. Let me read to you what just in June's schedule was for the month, okay?
Yeah, please. I'm curious.
June 2nd, Military Personnel Day, 10% off all day if you're military personnel in uniform. June 5th, World Environment Day. Everyone who joins the World Environment Day protest march that was held that day gets 10% off their purchases. June 8th, Coleslaw Day. The best coleslaw made in the store wins a $20 drink card and a double pass to the movies. June 10th, Balloon Basketball Day. 3 double passes to be won. June 11th, Balloon Soccer Day. Win 1 of 4 CDs and 1 Gaslight T-shirt. June 12th, Warwick Capper's birthday. Boy with the longest hair and the girl with the shortest hair wins a $20 drink card. June 13th, Queen's birthday. The first 4 people to sit for 10 minutes on the in-store throne loo. They've got a throne bathroom. Wearing the Gaslight crown and giving each customer a royal wave wins a double pass to the Longford Cinema. June 16th, the first person to come in at 12:30 and make any kind of hors d'oeuvres for a lunchtime customer for 20 minutes wins a double pass to the movies. June 17th, Staring Into the Mirror Marathon, dinner for 2 at the lounge. June 19th, Poetry Day, $20 book voucher for the Book Cave for the best 2-minute stream of consciousness poem. June 21st, Date to Insinuate, scream insinuations at Gaslight staff, the best 4 win double passes to the movies. June 22nd, Cane Toads, introduced to Australia in 1935, the first 4 customers to hop around the store and be a pest for 15 minutes win a double pass. June 23rd, the most unusual car double parked outside Gaslight today wins a gold pass to the Prince of Wales Hotel. June 25th, World Record Day. In-store world record attempts many prizes, including $50 drink cards at the Town Hall Hotel. June 28th, Unworthiness Day. The first person to proclaim, I am not worthy of a prize, wins a shirt and a T-shirt. June 30th, Lawnmower Day. The first person to bring in a lawnmower and mow the store wins a $20 drink card. Well, that's pretty wild, and the kind of business is wild, but you see the possibilities, Marty?
A lot of possibilities. How about a 45-second summary on promotion from Jay Abraham, the wizard?
If you've got any business or any profession, you can promote. You can promote on an understated or a very aggressive basis. You can promote for fun, or you can promote for distinction, to distinguish and acknowledge that your customers are special, to segment and respect different ones, to introduce them to new services, to have fun, to teach them information. If you don't have promotion being a regular scheduled part of your business, you are losing a very low-cost or no-cost leverage point that can give you distinction, can make doing business with you valuable, fun. It's essential you do it to some level. It's 45 minutes up?
Yep, it's up. That's it for this month's edition of The Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey, Communications Director, saying thanks for listening. We've got to go out and promote. Welcome once again to The Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey, the Communications Director. Jay, when did you first really begin to understand there was something called a unique selling proposition? Was this from one of your marketing greats, or did you intuitively understand there was something out there?
I can tell you exactly. It was in 1977, and in the year 78, it all came together. I had been successful basically by sheer concentrated force and the magnitude of my commitment, but I didn't really understand why certain things I did worked far more effectively and impactfully than others. I met a man who was one of the foremost marketing practitioners of his time back in 1977, and the company that I was running engaged that man just to share with me over a weekend his philosophies, his methodologies. It's a good process, by the way, Marty. When you meet somebody who is far more knowledgeable than you are in any or every aspect of selling, of business building, of profiteering, of communication, of advertising, of marketing, of influence, of persuasion, rather than being jealous, rather than being superficially curious, I always try to engage that person and either exchange with them something intangibly of valuable for the ability and the privilege of charmingly interrogating them, or I engage them on a fee basis, because you can normally get somebody who has millions of dollars or an invaluable, priceless amount of knowledge that he or she would be only too gratified to share with you if you're not competitive for a nominal price. We engaged this man for a weekend. We paid him a lofty fee. I was running a magazine, Entrepreneur Magazine to be exact. We paid this man a lofty fee. I think we paid him $15,000 for a weekend, but we gave it to him in advertising time that cost us all of $2,000, and I think it took him a year and a half to use it. So we paid him $2,000 that we really didn't even pay out for a year and a half. He gave us more than $1 million. He gave us, because I was able to interrogate him charmingly but very specifically to get to identify and discern the very critical elements I wanted to know about what he knew, and this was back in 77. One of the key fundamentals he shared with me was the importance, the criticalness, the all essential elements that had to exist relative to unique selling proposition. And he introduced me to the father of the theory, whose name is Rosser Reeves. Rosser Reeves was the chairman of Ted Bates Advertising Agency. I don't know what Bates' size is now, but it was one of the foremost, and he grew it very rapidly. And one of the critical fundamentals that enabled him to grow it to hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars was his keen understanding of unique selling proposition and its powerful impact and its force. He told a story, and I'm just going back and trying to set the foundation so people can appreciate this. He told a story about being at a luncheon one time with a group of very highly respected advertising and marketing men, and they were sitting listing. They were discussing. There were 37 different factors, any one of which could cause the sales of a product or service to move up or down in a marketplace. And advertising was only one of them. The product may have been wrong, Marty. The price may have been at fault, too high, too low, not palatable. Distribution may be poor. The sales force may not be adequate. The budget may be too low to drive what they needed for the front end or the residual sales needs of the product. A better competitor may be sweeping the market, or a competitor may be outwitting them with stronger propositions. There's so many variables that pull up or pull down a response in the success of any product promotion or advertisement or sales approach, and Rosser Reeves studied all of them. He just studied everything, and what he realized was that one of, if not the most fundamentally critical element in the whole success-selling proposition, and I got to make a parenthetical statement here, advertising is nothing more than salesmanship or saleswomanship in print or in electronically. And he studied selling and what the critical elements of selling were, and then he translated it to all the mediums, to written, to print, to electronic. And he realized there were so many variables that pulled up and pulled down, but that he understood that USP, unique selling proposition, was almost all-encompassing, and he cited a couple of really interesting and profound realizations that he concluded when he started doing very clinical research, because he started studying the results of all kinds of companies that spent a lot of money but didn't have definitive platforms they were building it on. He realized, like, he cites three case studies that I think I can remember. The first one was there were two separate advertisers in the same product line. I don't remember what the product line was right now, but one got their message successfully into 44% of the people's minds, and they responded. The other only had penetration of 1.8% for the same. They both spent $10 million.
Mm.
One competitor was 2,200% more effective and successful than their counterpart, even though they both spent the same money, because one understood unique selling proposition and the other didn't. There were two other advertisers. One spent $1 million on their product, small little niche companies. The other only spent $300,000. But the latter, the little one that spent $300,000, was able to get 60% of their market to spend with them. The bigger one, the one that spent $1 million, only got 5%. So there was a 1,200% difference because the first one did not understand USP, and the little one, the one that only spent less than a third, understood it mightily. The last example I think he cited was there was a food advertiser that was using a dramatic technique that totally overwrote his story. In other words, his proposition was being dwarfed by some really glitzy presentational style, and the presentational style so diffused and deflected and derailed the concentration of the advertiser that they actually lost something like 40% of their market share.
Mm.
All of those elements are byproducts of not understanding or maximizing the importance and the potency of unique selling proposition. It's a really powerful thing. You got to realize that USP gives you infinite leverage, and leverage is what you're striving for in any kind of competitive business. Leverage is the multiplying factor that lets the same or a lesser amount of expenditure, effort, or message produce a greater, a more enduring amount of results. That's what you're all after. Your proposition must be so strong, Marty, that it can move the masses to your product or service. Okay? Your advertising must get people to understand that by buying whatever it is you're offering, they will reap, they will enjoy, they will realize a very specific benefit or advantage. The whole concept of unique selling proposition is the most critical distillation of understanding of the question, what is in it for me, that is posed nonverbally by the consumer, by the customer, by the prospective business owner, if you're selling business to business, in every encounter you have, directly, on the phone, through letters, through advertisements, through brochures. What's in it for me? Most people don't understand that you have to telegraph a unique benefit or advantage, unique and advantageous in terms of the recipient, not the vendor. In other words, it doesn't matter if it's unique for you. What only matters is what's the unique advantage that I, as the customer, can and will receive, will get, will realize by favoring you with my purchase instead of your competitors. So the proposition must be one that the competitor either cannot or does not make or offer. It must be unique, other than the uniqueness of the product or a claim not otherwise made by a competitor. It's got to be something very, very powerful, very valuable, very dramatic, very tangible, or if it's intangible, very desired as far as an attribute the customer would like to possess or feel or experience. And until and unless you understand that, all you are is a commodity. Does that make sense, or am I being too confusing?
Okay, that's the dividing line between a commodity and something that has more value, is the USP.
Well, let's just start. Your goal, and I mean, I don't know if people realize this, you are a business owner, or you are a professional, you are contemplating starting a business, you are running with P&L responsibilities, a division, or a business for some other passive owner. That business, unless it's a one-of-a-kind business already, is a generic business. It's basically competing with other generic businesses. With very few exceptions, Marty, you don't have a lot of advantages. You all buy plus or minus 5 or 10% the same. You know, the quality and performance of the goods, plus or minus 5%, is probably about the same. You have to embody, you have to imbue, either or and preferably both, your product and your company with unique and distinguishing advantages that are evident and are conveyed to the buyer, to the customer, to the end user of your product or service, through the product or through the company rendering it, so they will see you offering them greater advantage than all the other entities they can choose favoring. Does that make sense?
Okay, it does. Can you give me several synonyms for unique selling proposition? I know this is critically important.
Distinguishing advantage, differentiation, perceived benefit, the deciding factor. Does that make sense?
Okay.
The element or elements that instantly and clearly and powerfully make it so much more appealing for me to deal with your company instead of your competitors. And it's different for all kinds of companies. And it can be different things for different markets that you compete with. And you've got to look within your company, and there's lots of different possibilities. But the unique selling proposition is a key foundational element that everybody listening to this session must incorporate into their business plan, into their strategy, into their way of conducting their business life. They've got to look within their business and identify first and foremost what it is about their business that provides a greater valuable benefit, either tangibly or emotionally, to the customer. Now, you'll remember back about four or five sessions, we talked about the strategy of preeminence. Do you remember that?
Right.
And in there, we talked about a lot of similar elements that cross-pollinate with this. But you've got to basically show people they will be more advantaged, more protected, feel better, be more special, or any combination therein. When developing and identifying unique selling proposition, there are a number of interesting processes you can go through. The first one is to look at your marketplace, your competitive marketplace, and make a list of what each and every one of your competitors, including you, do in the rendering of the product. Make a list of what the product or service does for the customer. Make a list of how the product or service is created and what went into its creation. Make lists of what it competes against or what it works in conjunction with or what it protects or eliminates or extends. Make lists of what it is engineered to perform to as far as performance characteristics. Make lists of how it's composed, in other words, what the construction elements of it might be. Make lists of the expertises that go into the vending or rendering of it from not only the time you and your company gets it, but all the way through from when it's a raw resource, how it got down to you. So you can tell the story in a very powerful way, because there's a lot of different options you have in forging your unique selling proposition. I will, in this quick session, go through a beginning base of it, and maybe we'll do a couple of special report-type tapes later, because I could do weeks on unique selling proposition. It's that deep and that critical, and long-term it can give you such profound advantage. And I think we talked a little bit about it when I was using a couple reference examples. I think I used in the top of mind years ago when Domino's first came to prominence. Their unique selling proposition was very simple: hot, fresh, delicious pizza delivered to your door in 30 minutes or less, or it's yours free. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
At that point, that was so unique and advantageous, not to Domino's, although it was, but to Domino's customers, because at the point no one else was offering A, rapid delivery, B, most people were, if you'll remember, there was an era right when Domino's started doing this where delivered pizza was pretty archaic. Mm-hmm. Most people were going out to a Shakey's or a Pizza Hut or wherever, and there was very little except an occasional independent who was delivering at that point. Do you remember that?
I remember. In fact,
it was almost unique that alone. The delivery was unique, but they didn't stop at that. The delivery was predicated on a double performance guarantee. Performance one was time, 30 minutes or less. Performance two was the qualitativeness and the desirability, hot, fresh, delicious, right?
Okay.
The number three was if we failed, it was free. There were four unique selling factors embodied together. Does that make sense?
It does. Risk reversal there.
Yeah, so you'll see that. I mean, by this point in the listener's subscription, they should see that a lot of these elements that I talk about interconverge, and they have implication in many different ways. And that's okay, because what I'm trying to do, quite frankly, is not boggle people's mind with specific technology, I'm more concerned with getting your mind redirected. If your mindset is strategically reoriented to the fact that you've got to have a greater advantage and you've got to be able to articulate, denominate, graphically illustrate, and communicate that advantage to your customer, whether you understand my explanation of unique selling proposition or not is moot. What's important is you'll change the way you operate your business, and in the process, you'll change the competitive advantages you have working in your favor, and you'll bring to bear one of the most formidable success forces ever known, working, empowering, and propelling you heads and tails above all your competitors. Federal Express, when they first started, they asked the question, when it absolutely, positively has to be there tomorrow by 10 o'clock, next day, FedEx. That was pretty powerful in an era when basically UPS back, I mean, now UPS is probably about thrice as dependable as it was before the advent of FedEx, because FedEx made them in a competitive catch-up role have to be more competitively advantageous. Number one, they did not have overnight. Number two, conventional UPS took sometimes 10 to 30 days, didn't it?
Right.
So the point is you've got to find the uniquely appealing self-serving advantages or benefits that the customer greatly desires. And maybe the customer has never even thought about because it's never been expressed that it was available. And there's lots of different ways to do it. The first one is to think up, I'm giving you this, I gave you earlier, and I took a little tangent, all the grids you can start making to figure out different factors you can weave together. Everyone's going to have their own USP basis, and keep in mind, you can have different USPs that you can telegraph to different target audiences within your broad market, because different people respond to or are motivated by different things. Does that make sense?
Right.
For example, there was a company, and this is almost going to sound funny, but there was a company that we did years and years ago. I was involved in the heavy equipment manufacturing business. I worked for a very large firm that made road graders back during the Vietnam War that they sent over to Vietnam to make roads so we could go in and do whatever in the world we did. And these road graders cost $1.5 million a piece to make. They were very large and very complicated. They were constructed with, I think, something like 4,000 different fasteners, screws, bolts, nuts, all kinds of different sizes. Some of them were massive. I mean, I've seen bolts that were 2 feet long and, 5 inches in circumference. Problem was, in manufacturing, the production line would cost thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars an hour to keep running. If manufacturing got their inventory screwed up and they ran out of something as silly as a hex head nut, a 2-inch hex head nut, which was a very popular fastener, the whole line would stop and it would cost tens of thousands of dollars until they got new ones. Conventional manufacturers manufactured to order. They did not stock.
Okay.
So you'd buy 10,000, but if you screwed up on your order or if a conventional manufacturer was backlogged and you didn't have provisions in stock, the whole line got screwed. And that happened about once a week. Don't ask me why. It just was a fact of life. There was a company called Service Supply, and Service Supply had a neat nomenclature. It was called the House of a Million Screws. And it was a little funny, but the truth of the matter is they had in inventory the kind of fasteners that big manufacturing plants almost always ran out of, and they would ship it to you same day if you were there and the next day anywhere around the world. Well, what that allowed them to do, because their unique selling proposition was basically restated, when you run out of a fastener, we guarantee to have it in stock and we'll have it in your hands at the very latest tomorrow morning and more probably today. Because of that critical fact, they could charge 100 times more for a screw than you would pay conventionally because its value is so critical to you,
mm-hmm.
And they made millions of dollars. Unique selling proposition is the ability to identify the most advantageous or desired or critical factors that the customer wants, desires, can benefit from, and telegraphing that to him or her as part of your selling proposition, and making sure you hold that advantage out in a way your competitors don't. It can be so many different things. I've engineered all kinds of unique selling propositions for people. The typical ones are extending the performance guarantees of the product, extending the performance expectations and denominating them, 2, extending the guarantee of the product, 3, adding more complimentary bonuses to the product, 4, adding greater follow-through as far as service, support, or warranty type things. Number 2, I almost always try to get my clients to understand and denominate to people the construction elements that go into creating or rendering their product or service, because even though it is oftentimes similar for all kinds of generic products, the first company that goes to the effort of explaining it gets decisive advantage. And I also believe on one of the earlier sessions of The Wizard's Edge, we talked about preemptive advertising, and we used as an example Schlitz, didn't I?
We developed that story.
Well, that story is a perfect embodiment of unique selling proposition. In a time when everyone was saying platitudinally and basically hyperbolically, our beer is pure, our beer is pure, our beer is pure, Schlitz, who had no other advantage, decided they would take preemptively as their advantage, proving and explaining and sharing with people how they made their beer pure, which frankly was the very same process that virtually every other brewer went through. However, none of them had seen fit to share it with the marketplace. And when Schlitz did it, they became distinctive and preemptive, and everybody basically felt their beer was many times pure because they shared the process. Everyone else just uttered the words.
Yeah.
So depending, let's say that you are a manufacturing concern and you're selling a product that would seem generic. Well, ways you can give a generic product unique selling advantage might be the following. Number one, do something in the engineering or the construction or the components of the product that lets you tell a story about adding an additive that elongates or extends or more assures the duration or the performance or the durability. In other words, engineered to last 4 times as long as our closest competitor without a problem. And if you've got the wherewithal and the willingness, even guarantee that or guarantee a portion of that. Now, we talked about guarantees in a previous one, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the fact that there's no necessity that you guarantee 100% of any transaction. You can guarantee any portion. And I used a real estate transaction as an example, I think, where it would be virtually cost prohibitive to say, if you don't like it, I'll buy the house back. But it isn't difficult to guarantee the fact that people can first and foremost check out all the other people you've served to see if they felt like they basically got great advice and the home they bought or the way they sold it was more advantageous by favoring you than favoring your competitor. Then you can offer them, if they're unhappy within a year, you will sell the house for them for nothing, you will buy them a house for no commission, and you'll share with them the moving expenses. So you can do a lot of neat guarantees. So the point is, you got to find characteristics. If you can engineer a product, or if you can design it, or if you can add a component that is intended on adding greater performance, greater precision, greater durability. In other words, if the normal product is designed to go 3 hours at a time and yours is engineered to go 7, if the normal product is designed to go 6 months and must be replaced and yours is designed to go a year, if the normal product comes with a 3-week or a 3-month guarantee and yours can be 6 or 9 or a year, and you can test that to make sure that your exposure on loss and replacement and refunding is tolerable and acceptable, those are powerful, unique selling advantages that your competitors don't have. Does that make sense?
Makes sense. And you made reference to a grid, and it seems to me you have discovered a whole lot of these unique selling propositions. No one necessarily knows what they are in the beginning. How does that grid work?
Well, you basically start, it's almost like a Rubik's Cube or a kaleidoscope. You ask questions. You ask, what about this? Is this valuable to my customer? What elements of this? And I gave you the three or four, and I'm sorry, I don't remember what all three or four of them were, because I sort of spew them off the top of my head. Because I do everything pretty much spontaneously. It's become just a way of life to me. I'm trying to basically break it down for all our listeners into a very scientific and strategic manner, but we'll have to go back. What I try to do mentally is I make these grids and I instantaneously inventory. Oh, I ask a barrage of questions. And as they're answering me, I throw back critical elements. In other words, what are the compositions? If they tell me, well, it's got certain kind of wood, I'll say why, and they'll say, well, because that wood outperforms cherry by five times, and I'll say, does the market know that? And they'll say no, and I'll say, well, don't you think that might be an element? And we'll ask a lot of questions, and we'll create a basket of possible elements, factors, or choices that can be our unique selling proposition, or it can be the structure we built a multi-tiered USP on. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah.
And then you have to sort of depends on the application, because each situation is different. You might basically ask yourself this question too. Go through everybody you deal with in your life, in your business, if you have a business, in your profession, if you have a profession, in your personal life, in your home, and ask what about them endears you to them, and write it down. If you buy your clothing from a certain clothier, what is about that clothing store that makes them stand out, since you have an infinite choices? If you have a yard, maintaining your yard, or somebody who keeps your pool clean, or a specific auto dealer or mechanic that you go to. What is it about them? And try to define it, not in abstraction, like quality, service, dependability, because that's what most people think their USP is. And it's the most vacuous, nondescript. It doesn't mean anything to anybody other than you. When you, as the business owner, utter the words quality, service, dependability, your mind conjures up some very specific visions. But that's not true in the mind of the customer. It's nebulous, it's abstract, it's non-definitive. What does service mean? Does service mean that when you have a problem, when you're due for service, we call you, we write you, we come out, we pick up your car, we deliver another one, we test drive it, we bring it back to you, we ride around with it, we make certain you know what we've done, we make certain you know the implication? See, that's a very big difference between service, quality, and dependability.
So really, just simply on the front end here, people could just take maybe their little catchwords that are not really communicating and find out what pictures they see in their mind or what they hear when they're saying that, and then explain that.
The hardest thing, Marty, and sometimes I won't say yes, but it's evident if I don't say no, then I agree with you.
Yeah.
The hardest thing that most people try to do in life is deep, concentrated thought that gets to very specific conclusions. Most of us don't know how to do that. We've never forced ourselves to really define things. The greatest ally you've got is a yellow legal pad and a pen or a bunch of 3x5 cards. And with regard to USP, which has the capacity of explosively catapulting any business ultimately over a long period to preeminence in their field more than anything else, but it's the hardest element to get right, you got to do some deep thought, because you got to ask yourself, what is it that I can offer a customer that's so much more valued by them that they'll favor me over my competitors? And it can't just be, what do I think I can offer that's different? That difference has to have enough self-serving value and desirability and importance that the customer will favor it. In other words, you might have a savings of a dollar, but you might be so far away in location that it isn't worth coming to get that savings. Do you understand that?
Right.
So you got to use reality. And the biggest and saddest observation I make of all the companies I work with is that most business owners live in a vacuum that's self-consumed. They are obsessed with what they think the market wants, not what the market wants. They're obsessed with giving the market what they think is important to the market, not what the market thinks is important. They're obsessed with doing what they think is innovative, but they don't understand that innovation is only relevant if it translates and transcends into a greater benefit or a greater advantage or a greater profit or protection to the customer. I mean, in other words, if you and I have the greatest innovative system in place and the greatest manufacturing capacity and everything else, but we don't pass on some advantage or combination advantages to the customer, it's meaningless. If we don't give them a greater price, greater delivery, greater performance, greater something that they want and they will value more than the competition, it's useless. It's moot. Also, one of the factors in creating your USP is denominating results. If you can denominate a very specific, a very tangible, a very measurable result or benefit that's not abstract, you normally can make your product or service or company stand out extremely more favorably. And that denomination is an easy process. It's not fast, but it's easy. It occurs when you go back in time and you look at how the product is engineered, what the minimum performance characteristics are, what a bunch of your past customers have actually experienced from using, applying, depending on the product in terms of what its implication is in the totality of however it's used. Am I being too abstract or not?
No, but I have thought about asking you to talk about some of the clients you've worked with.
Okay, well, I'll go through a bunch of them. Years ago, we did a product called Icy Hot, and Icy Hot was an analgesic balm. And we basically told people it relieved temporarily the aches and pains and the maladies caused by arthritis, bursitis, things like that. We were competing against Bengay, mentholatum, and people like that. Our approach was very simple. Deeper, more penetrating, faster, longer, more satisfying relief, or your money back. But first we told people to use the whole jar and then decide for themselves. No one ever was that. I mean, when you say satisfaction guaranteed, that's nebulous, isn't it?
Right.
If I say use the whole jar, try it on your worst pain, compare it against anything else you're using. It's got to be faster, it's got to be deeper, it's got to last longer, it's got to give you more blessed temporary relief, or I will return your money and you keep the jar, no questions asked. Now, what's stronger?
Wait, now, how did you come up with faster and deeper in that USP?
Because we analyzed the composites of the construction of the product.
Oh.
We saw that we had more elements that provided faster relief. We had more elements that lingered longer. We looked at the letters we were getting from people who used it, and they cited that very premise that it was faster, it was longer, it was deeper, it was more blessed. So we let the customers tell us what to tell them.
Okay.
And it was a very vast success. When I was involved, years ago, I was involved in the lead generating business. We had clients all over the country who generated investment leads, customer leads, sales leads, magazine subscription leads. We had millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of customers. We performed our service on a contingency basis. We were going to people who normally invested a lot of money in advertising or in direct letters, selling letters, to try to generate leads. Some of them worked, some of them didn't. Some of them generated good leads, some of them generated bad leads, some of them generated no leads, some of them generated leads at a cost of $1,000 a piece, some of them generated leads at a cost of $1, some of them generated leads that didn't convert. We basically had a very powerful USP. We worked on a contingency basis, meaning we didn't get paid unless we performed. We worked on a basis that they determined what a lead was worth. We worked on a basis that we would only ask and be paid for leads that were acceptable, meaning leads that converted profitably to customers. Our unique selling proposition was very clear. We said, don't pay for advertising, pay for results.
And
it
is powerful. The response to that was good?
Yeah, we sold, I don't know, $20 million worth of lead generating services in 1 year. It was pretty good. I was involved in Entrepreneur Magazine when it was first starting out. And the key element there was our USP was we knew who was making a bundle in small businesses, and we wanted to share that with you. Everyone else was talking about the, basically the business philosophy. We were basically appealing, we decided our USP niche, and you should think about it in niche, because you're trying to identify either a real or an emotional or a benefit niche that none of your competitors have ever recognized or played to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, this whole discussion is different than I had expected it to be.
Good or bad?
Well, good, but
what did you think we were going to talk about?
Well, I know that unique selling proposition is at the core, but in some ways, this is all just the very ultimate essence of business.
Well, it is, except for, the great opportunity and also the great problem and the great lament that I have is that most business owners don't have the slightest clue to the meaning of business life. They think it's all about basically spending a lot of time, having a lot of commitment, working a lot of hours, being honest. That people don't understand that just as every issue of this, I mean, we talked about this before, Marty, people who subscribe to the Wizard's Edge, they paid whatever, $500 a year for this. To me, $500 is about a sixth of an hour of my time. To them, $500 is probably the most expensive year-long subscription they've ever invested in their life, don't you think?
Yeah.
So, basically, every time another session comes, they've got to be silently and not even consciously asking themselves or saying to themselves, this better be good, this better really perform, this better really produce for me, self-servingly, me, the subscriber, one tremendous payoff, one tremendous benefit, one tremendous result, or I basically won't keep it, or I basically don't feel I got value. Isn't that true?
Right.
That's no different than every one of your customers is unconsciously, non-verbally, just implicitly thinking about you. And if you're a generic business and you have no advantage, you're just lucky to be in business. You're lucky. People don't understand why their businesses don't go anywhere. They don't understand why their businesses regress. They don't understand why their businesses don't have a lot of loyalty. But it all stems from the fact that you can only get loyalty if you convey advantage. Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
Why would I? I mean, if I am a rational human being, I evaluate. I mean, why would I want to keep favoring you if I get nothing or less or no denominated value when I have constant options? I think you've got to realize that getting a customer, it's a little complicated, but it's a critical distinction. When you acquire a customer, your job has just begun. Far too many business owners listening to this interview delude themselves to believe that the moment they get a customer, they have an enfranchised right and a toehold on that customer forever. And that's anything but the truth. The moment you get that customer unconsciously and unaware even themselves are constantly evaluating you against all the options. You only get loyalty if you give advantage. Think about it. I mean, if you have friendships and you're fiercely loyal, why are you loyal? You could say, I like that person, but doesn't that like manifest itself in the fact that that person gives you a feeling of being special, important, valuable. That person gives you something you desire. That person makes you laugh, makes you feel good, makes life exciting. It's not about liking, it's about getting something for yourself very advantageous. And the more you develop the ability to call out and identify and understand the unique selling advantages that make you loyal and responsive and desirous of favoring people and places with your loyalty, your patronage, your friendship, your love, and you transfer that same embodiment to your business, you will give yourself advantage. Does that make sense, Marty?
Yeah, it does.
It's simple, but it's powerful because I don't think how many people have ever explained it this way.
Well, you have.
It's a pretty powerful thought. So you got all these options. And as I said, the first thing is you try to, I'll go through a couple other of my experiences and that'll help maybe.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to hear that.
I basically sold newsletters. And when we sold newsletter subscriptions, the goal was most newsletter subscribers would say, we made money last year for people. We called the top. We called the bottom of gold and silver. We think we can do it again. If we do it, you make money. If not, you can have a refund at the end of the year. I thought that basically what that said was you got to waste a lot of money, and if we're wrong, you can have a refund, but you lost all your money. My approach was different. My approach was we will lower our price for the first year if you agree to paper trade because we don't want you to lose money. We don't think we'll lose money. We haven't for all the other people who followed our advice, but you never know. We may be right for you, we may not. What we want you to do is paper trade us for 6 months to a year, and only if and after you see our advice pay off handsomely and comfortably and securely for you on paper, do we want you to put your own money at risk, and will we consider your purchase or your subscription binding? Well, it was we sold 700,000 subscriptions that way because everyone else was basically most people. I'm being fragmented in my explanation. Most businesses, if you analyze their message, all they are saying is, give me the business you normally give to somebody else. And they're failing to add the most critical addition to their selling proposition, the because, the reason why. Why should I give you your business?
Okay.
What's the promise? What's the benefit? What's the result? What's the advantage? What's the protection? What's the guaranteed performance or outcome or a combination of all those? Does that make sense?
It does. It seems sometimes when I start thinking about this, though, is a person ever scared to look at actually what he or she is offering?
At first it is. By the way, this same philosophy, which I am giving everybody listening for application in their business, applies to your life. It applies to your personal relationships with your spouse, with your children, with your friends. It applies to your leadership roles in causal or fraternal or religious or social environments. It's all the same. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, yeah.
Turn the tape over now as we conclude the program on Side 2.
I mean, why do people favor one person, one business, one product, one service over another? And if you don't know, I mean, there's no great mystery except for most of us are unwilling to pay the price of analysis. And all you do is analyze. Look in your own life. Who do you really love dealing with in either business, in friendship, in life, in your job, in your company? What is it about them? What do they represent? What elements, what benefits to you? And don't just say, I like. Go beneath the surface. What is it about the transaction or the ongoing transaction that you get out of it that is self-servingly more advantageous, more desirable, more attractive to you than other people, places, things, or professionals you deal with? It's so simple that it's embarrassing. Once you identify what your options are, then you got to figure out which ones have the most, the broadest or the deepest or the most dimensional appeal, because there's probably 5 or 10 different USP possibilities you can build any business on. The question is which one or which composite ones have the biggest mass appeal and telegraph the greatest self-serving advantages so that the largest segment of the marketplaces you're trying to reach will desire it and will keep seeing that as a repetitive desire.
Okay.
And it differs. But that's the whole philosophy of USP.
Okay.
Now, what did you think I was going to tell you? The nice thing for the listeners is you are advocating their role. You don't necessarily know what we're going to cover when we do these interviews, do you?
No.
You've got the same fresh curiosity, sense of discovery, and advocacy. And if there's a point or a part that doesn't make sense or you think could be embellished, you're going to advocate it for them.
See, it seems to me understanding USP is almost a growing proposition.
It changes, and it can be broken into substratas. You can have a different USP for different segments of a marketplace you address, and you can have different USPs for different products or services you sell. There are no rules. The most important, again, I'm integrating a lot of my philosophies in this in an embodiment that's really very powerful, although it seems a little bit simple. There are no rules that govern the way you conduct your business, except that you should always be striving to give yourself greater advantage. You should always be striving to multiply the effect, the effectiveness, the result, the profitability, and the residual value of everything you do. And to do that means you don't want to telegraph no advantage if you can telegraph a superior advantage. You don't want to telegraph a superior advantage if you can instead telegraph an optimal advantage. And you got to keep working. But the first point is, if you got no advantage, you need some advantage. Then you might build on that. You can test it by watching it. And it's very easy to test different USPs because you embody it into your sales message, whether it's live, presented at somebody's office, on the phone, in your facility, whether it's written. You will see when you try one advantage to 1,000 people or 500 people or 50 people or 10 people and a different advantage, that one will produce far greater sense of response and closure or sales or dollars than the other, and one will produce greater repeat. And the market will always tell you what they want. Your biggest chore is going to be to ask them and question them in the form of experimental tests, of listening to them, of interviewing them, of evaluating what it is about your product or your company or your people or its or the composition or their training or the construction of your product or service that is the most powerfully appealing on a self-serving basis to your customers. And then, after you think you've got the answer, proving that you've got the answer, not being lazy and just arbitrarily deciding because it sounds good, but letting the market validate or invalidate. And if it's invalidated, don't be upset, because that's exhilarating. They're telling you, no, don't go in that direction. We want something else. They'll always tell you. You'll always be a sales and marketing genius. You'll always be able. You'll always, Marty, be able to perform superior to your competitor if you always ask your market questions.
Okay. Okay. How about changing gears here for the rest of the tape a little?
Okay.
You talk about the three ways to grow business. Can you give us some actual specifics in that?
Sure. I absolutely can, Marty. First of all, let's go back and revisit the philosophy so we have everybody in absolute, the proper state of mind and sync and orientation and realization. All these people that are listening came to us with the desire to grow their business, increase their profits, give themselves competitive advantage, reduce their expenses, assure their future, gain control, and all the other things. They think it's very difficult. They think it's very complex. They think it's very esoteric. Quite honestly, the opposite is true. There's only three ways, as I said on one or two other interviews we've done, to grow any business and every profession. Three factors only determine the outcome up or down of the business that you run or that you own. Number one, the number of customers you have and keep. Number two, the average unit of sale and the corresponding profit therein of the transactions you conduct. Number three, the incidence of repurchase or the frequency of repurchase or the residual value those customers are worth to you for not only your own product or services or products, but for any other products or services you can assist your customers to buy through you, directly or indirectly, that you can benefit from. Those are the only three ways: increase customers, increase sale, increase frequency of sale, or other products or services you can sell your customers. If you can affect any of those areas, you increase your business, any of those areas upwardly. If you can improve any of those areas, you increase your business linear. If you can improve two or more of those areas, you increase your business exponentially or geometrically. That's how you give businesses a quantum leap without a lot of complex effort. That's how simple little shifts in improving the performance of things you currently do sort of ad hoc and without thinking, without formalization or strategic thought, can give you doubles or triples or quadruples or 10-time growth in profit, certainly, and in sales often. So that said, let me go through some examples, okay?
Please.
Okay. First of all, let's do this in a structured, formalized manner. Let's start with the first category that most people solely think about growing the number of customers you sell to. There's so many different ways to do it, but let's look at doing it through a couple. First of all, the easiest cashless way to do it is by instituting a formal referral system. If you look at your business and your business renders any kind of a qualitative and a desired and a valued product or service, chances are strong that a certain portion of your customer base has emanated and grown to you and originated through some kind of referral. If you start a more formalized referral system, you can expect that your customers will grow even greater. A system can be as simple as every time you get a customer, a new one, saying, you know, our whole business is built by people like you referring more people of your quality. We don't have a large advertising budget. We don't have a lot of salespeople in the field. Our growth is dependent on your ability to first of all, be eminently satisfied and love dealing with us so much that you're comfortable and actually inclined to want to tell other people and then doing it for us. We appreciate that, and we will gladly reward you. By having a formalized referral system, it's very powerful. We played the Patty Lund interview, and you remember by listening to that, those who listened to it, it actually is the story of a dentist that made generating referrals a condition of doing business with his dentistry. You can be so formalized. Now, it's very important that every methodology that I refer to here has within it probably 5 to 25 nuances. So when I tell you, you can and must develop a referral system, I want to clarify, there are 25 different ways you can do that, and the shrewdest and the most astute entrepreneurs that I work with and that I've met develop not one but multiple facets of referral systems working in harmony. Mm-hmm. There's so many different ways to do it that I could take this entire session doing it. I'll give you a little secret to figure out for yourself what's best. If you are a business owner, singular or plural, maybe there's a couple or partners listening to this tape, or a study group, go to 10 or 25 other business owners you know in your community, particularly people who are not, underscore not, in the business you're in. Ask them how they have successfully and if they have successfully generated customers through referral. If they say yes, ask them to define and explain to you their definition and their interpretation and their approach to referral marketing. If you interview 10 people, you will find 5 different ways they refer than you do. If you can pick out the embodiments of those 5 ways which best apply to you in the most workable and tangible manner and implement 1 to all 5 of them, you can watch your referral customer segment of your business grow rapidly. It is the most profitable, the most loyal, the most qualitative. If you study people who've emanated from referral, they normally buy the most, they buy the most often, they complain the least, and they are the loyalist. You want very, very critically to have a formalized referral system implemented in your business because it will produce the highest quality, the most profitable. There's no cost of sales unless you give them a little gift or something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes good sense.
So the first thing you want to do is have a referral system. That's the first, foremost, no-cost way you grow your customers. By the way, a flip side of growing your customers is eliminating attrition. Most people never think in terms of attrition. You know what attrition is, Marty?
Right, falling away, falling
right.
off.
If you look at any business, and let's say you have 1,000 customers, if you look at your business from its inception, and if you kept all the customers you've ever dealt with, you probably would have had 5,000 customers, but 4,000 fell by the wayside. Certainly some moved. Some outgrew their need for your product or service for any of a number of reasons, and I don't know what your product or service. Maybe they socioeconomically gravitated, maybe they got too old, maybe their kids no longer there, whatever the reason. So you discount those. But a very large number stopped dealing with you probably because they didn't get enough advantage and somebody else offered them greater advantage or they had other alternatives for the same effort, the same dollars, the same time.